Studies estimate that at least one in every five veterans has PTSD after returning from Iraq or Afghanistan. Today, we talk with two Iowans working to change that statistic. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury, in for Ben Kiefer. Today, I'll talk with two veterans. Stephen Lancaster of Drake University discusses his new study on how a soldier's military identity affects their likelihood of experiencing PTSD. And I'll hear from Richard Kresser, who ran the entire length of this year's RAGBRAI to raise funds for the Iowa Veterans Home. We'll see how he's holding up after his 416-mile run. That's all coming up right after the news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury, in for Ben Kiefer. Today, we are talking about veterans with veterans. Later in the program, I'll speak with a service member who decided to run this year's RAGBRAI on foot in order to generate donations for the Iowa Veterans Home in Marshalltown. But first, my guest is Stephen Lancaster. Stephen is an assistant professor of psychology at Drake University. He just finished a study taking a look at how a soldier's military identity affects their likelihood of experiencing symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. Stephen is also a veteran himself, having served in the National Guard as a combat engineer in Iraq in 2004. Stephen, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
So you were deployed to Iraq during your senior year of college to find and remove enemy IEDs, or otherwise known as improvised explosive devices. Tell me a little bit more about the job.
Yeah, it was quite the shock. The war started during my junior year of college, and sure enough, halfway through kind of my senior year, I got deployed. We had a number of jobs while we were in Iraq, but one of the most important and I think most interesting ones is for much of the time we were stationed right on the Iraq-Iran border, and as a result of the Iraq-Iran war, we think now often of when we think about war, we think about kind of packing everything up and going home. But in that case, people just kind of left everything and went home. And what this meant was that there was literally thousands of leftover bombs in farmers' fields. There were landmines in farmers' fields, things that children could play with, and certainly things that could be then turned into bombs to be used against American and other countries' soldiers during their deployments. And so what we would do is we would kind of search literally the fields, finding these old munitions, these old bombs, and then we would dispose of them in a way that was much safer than people trying to recycle them for the metal, for example.
Were you afraid?
No, not really. I had a really good group of guys that I was with. I was very confident in our training. The things that we were doing, the munitions that we were working with, were generally pretty stable, and so in general, no, I was confident in the training that I had and the men that I was with.
Mm-hmm. You know, we're talking this hour about traumatic experiences and how military service members kind of internalize that. Did you go through an experience that really, you know, changed the way you looked at things, that changed your perception, that was particularly maybe even traumatic?
You know, that's a good question. We certainly had our share of events while we were there. I think for me, it was kind of more the experience of kind of going through that overall deployment experience. It was actually much more impactful for me, which is one of the things that has kind of translated into my work. But for me, it was more of that experience of going through the deployment, of spending that time away from home. That was much more stressful for me, being away from my family, for example, than anything else that I could have encountered in combat, interestingly enough. And so for me, it was more that experience of being away that was the most impactful rather than any kind of any specific event.
Did other Guard members feel the same way?
I would say probably not. I mean, certainly we all dealt with you know, those kinds of isolation and being alone or kind of away from our families, I should say. But there was definitely guys in my unit and in other units who were much more significantly impacted. And you could see that the kind of their behavior changed throughout the deployment. They became, you know, not really interested in doing the job anymore. They were really struggling kind of emotionally. So you could see some of those changes in the guys.
And with the people that experienced those changes, I'm assuming before they were kind of lively and happy-go-lucky, possibly, and then they experienced these changes. Did you keep up with them after you came back? Do you know what happened to them?
Yeah, I've kept up with many of them, and, you know, many of them struggled when we got back. There was actually some of the guys in the unit who were doing okay while we were deployed and then had struggled with some of those reintegration issues that you've probably heard a lot about in the news, and really kind of struggled on that end. But talking to the guys who were struggling while we were there, it seems like many of them over time have kind of what you could say kind of recovered or are doing better at least. You know, it's been almost a decade now that we've been back, and so time has helped. Many of them have received some form of treatment, which has been very, very beneficial. So I think that, you know, they're definitely, you know, while it was a struggle at the time, I think many of them are doing much better now, which is I'm very happy for.
So your research focuses on pre-war military identity and how that can impact whether someone will experience anxiety or post-traumatic stress disorder. What is a pre-war military identity?
Well, we actually focus more on kind of their identity as they're getting out of the service. So it's actually more of kind of a post-war, post-deployment kind of identity that we're interested in. I think certainly some of the work we've done looked at kind of pre-deployment as well, but most of my recent research has looked at people really as kind of the end, as they're looking back. And so what that really means is, what we're really curious about is, do people identify, do they kind of define part of themselves, who they are currently as that member, as a veteran, as someone who was in the military? And so that can take lots of different forms, what that might look like. But what we're really interested in at the core is, you know, if people say, I am a veteran, that's who I am, what we're really curious about is that beneficial? Is that negative? And when might it be each?
When you came back to the U.S., is there something that you observed that made you want to explore this?
So it was actually while I was deployed, I got really interested in this area. What I noticed was the guys in my unit were responding to these events in really different ways. People like myself, I was actually kind of glad to get deployed. I sort of needed a change in my life, and certainly deployment was a big change. So I kind of viewed it as a positive in my life, and other people really struggled, and I got really interested in, well, why is there such this variation? Why are some people doing so well and some people struggling so much? And then when I got back, I entered graduate school in psychology, started working towards my doctorate in psychology. And working in the VA facilities, one of the things I noticed was just the huge variation in how much people identify themselves as a veteran. Some people I could do multiple sessions of therapy and they would never talk about their military experience. Other people would show up for their first session completely, you know, clothed head to toe in military related gear. And so I saw this big variation and it got me thinking, well, is it a good thing to wear all that military clothing, or is it a bad thing, or is it good for some and bad for others? And that's when I really got interested in this idea of identity, really, was from that experience working at the VA hospital.
Mm-hmm. And you reached out to all generations of veterans.
Yeah. So in the current study, it was an online study. Many studies are kind of based in the VA or will work specifically with a unit in the military. But this was an online study. And so anyone who was a veteran was eligible to participate. And we had veterans who were fresh back from Iraq and Afghanistan, all the way up to, I think, our oldest participant was 77 years old. So we had a really big range in the current project, which I think is really interesting.
Did the results of the survey match what you expected to find?
Well, in some ways, the study was kind of exploratory. These are kind of new ideas. This idea of military identity as a variable to study, as something to research, has been kicked around kind of theoretically for a while, but hadn't really been studied what we would call empirically, you know, really creating a measure and doing data analysis, those kinds of things. And so some of the aspects worked out like we expected. So, for example, we found that the number of days per week that somebody wears military-related clothing predicts their level of post-traumatic stress disorder, which is really interesting.
In what way? What did you find, you know, in that specific example?
Yeah. So what we found is that the more days, the higher the level of PTSD. Now, I want to be careful to make, you know, I don't want to be clear that you can't just wear less military-related clothing and your PTSD is going to go away. That's not what I'm talking about here. But what I think it does serve as kind of a marker that there's something about identifying with the military that seems to be relevant to level of PTSD. Now, it could also be that the stronger someone's PTSD is, the more likely they are to wear military clothing. And those are some things that we have to kind of follow up with future projects.
Do you know why that could be?
Well, I think it might tie back into this idea of identity. If you think about it, if you experience in your life something really negative, just aside from a comment, for example, someone loses their job. Well, if they didn't like that job very much and it's not very important to them, it might not impact them as much as someone who lived for their job, loved their job. It was the job they'd always dreamed of. If they lose that job, it's going to impact them a lot more than someone who doesn't really care about it. And in the same way, if someone's really, really committed to the military is very important to them, how they see themselves, a core part of who they are as a veteran or a member of the military, and something bad happens and they start to struggle, that might impact them more than someone who the military is not that important to them, or less important to them, I should say.
Mm-hmm. So as, you know, friends and family members and the public interacting with veterans, you know, how do you think we should approach this? Is it better to, you know, be open about it or not talk about it as much?
You know, I think that's a great question. And it's always a delicate question, because you can really go to either extreme, where you ask people lots and lots of kind of personal and comfortable questions that people aren't simply ready to talk about. The other extreme can be simply ignoring it. And that can also cause damage to people who are really struggling. And I think you've seen recently kind of outreach efforts from the government saying, hey, this is stuff that's okay to talk about. If you need to talk about it, find someone to talk about it with. And so I think for family members, it's important. And for friends, it's important to kind of, one, meet people where they're at. That is, you know, if they're obviously uncomfortable talking about something, it's probably best to let it go. But also providing them a space to kind of to vent, or if they need to talk about their experience, or if they're reminded of something, to be sensitive to that. And that can be particularly important around holidays, 4th of July. Also what we call kind of anniversary dates. So, for example, if someone experienced a traumatic event on a certain day in the military, for many veterans that day going forward can be very difficult. And to the degree that family members and friends know about that, providing extra support around that time can be really valuable.
We talked about military members wearing clothing for a certain number of days a week. That was a good predictor. What else were good predictors of whether they may experience anxiety?
Yeah, so great question. We actually looked at a couple of different interesting outcomes in the current project. The first was level of PTSD symptoms. We also looked at overall life satisfaction. And we also looked at a variable an idea that people have probably thought about but have maybe never heard of, and that's called post-traumatic growth. And what post-traumatic growth is basically people after stressful experiences will often report some kind of benefit, some kind of positive change that happened in their life. Now, that's not to say that they didn't also experience some very negative things, and it's not in any way to minimize the very powerful nature of traumatic experiences. But often clinically and in research, people will say, I grew as a result of this event. And so in our study, we looked at both PTSD symptoms as well as this idea of post-traumatic growth. And what we found is that sometimes different aspects of military identity predicted one but not the other. So, for example, the number of bumper stickers that someone has on their car that are military-related was actually related to the amount of kind of positive benefit they had. And so, again, you know, that again, it's not like you can just add more bumper stickers to your car and it's going to change your outlook on life. But it does serve this kind of – it serves as kind of a proxy or an indicator of identity. The other thing that we found is that the number of current friends that you have that are veterans or are still in the military, was that we could use that number to predict how much PTSD a person had, how much post-traumatic growth they reported, and even how satisfied they were with life in general. So all of these kind of real-life outcome variables seem to be very important.
That post-traumatic growth, kind of learning or growing from a harrowing experience – can we look at the people who experienced that growth and use it to help others who are struggling?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's been one of the big kind of debates within the field recently as well. This growth seems to be a good thing. But the question is it something we should try to enlarge, to encourage? Should it be an aim? If somebody comes in for therapy, should we try to get them to see the benefits of the event? And as you can imagine, that could be done in a very insensitive way if done improperly, where, you know, well, what's the positive of your, you know, bad experience? That's not really what we're talking about. But what we are looking at is there has been some work showing that the level of post-traumatic growth can be increased as you kind of work through and talk about various events. So there can be some room there. It does look like there are some things. One of the big things that we're trying to look at right now as researchers is kind of who reports growth and who reports distress and how can we differentiate those two. And that's kind of one of the really interesting things that I'm working on right now.
If you just tuned in, I'm talking with Stephen Lancaster. He's an assistant professor of psychology at Drake University, and we're talking about his latest study on how a soldier's military identity may affect their likelihood of experiencing PTSD or anxiety-related issues when they get back. And Stephen, you know, when we look at the different generations of veterans, you know, you have World War II vets coming home, and then you had Vietnam veterans, and they had quite a different experience. You know, how much do you think today's veterans are supported when they come home?
Yeah, that's a really important issue. And I think that's one of the things that I've been really encouraged by over the last decade as I've kind of followed veterans and veteran-related issues is I think the government and society and organizations have really stepped up to try to be as supportive as possible to veterans who are returning. And this is, you see just an absolute flurry of nonprofits being created, hoping to benefit veterans in every way possible. I worked with veterans who were given Segway scooters who needed it, who weren't able to walk very well. And so they were given Segway scooters. You see a lot of organizations who are providing dogs and other pets to veterans. You see recognition events. And so all of these things, I think, really are aimed in the right direction. That is to let veterans know, look, you know, we care about you. We're here to support you. I think one of the things that's really important for people to realize is that for many veterans, the battle doesn't end when they leave Iraq or Afghanistan or whatever country they've been deployed to. For many people, the reintegration is just as stressful and just as difficult. And so, you know, showing a lot of support to a veteran when they first return is wonderful. Many of them appreciate it. But, you know, check in at 3 months, check in at 6 months. For many, the struggle begins after they return. And so some of those sustained kind of efforts, I think, are going to be really important. But I think in general, been very, very encouraged by just the level of care and concern shown by society at large.
And, you know, when we think about military identity, I think a lot of people think about the training that military service members go through. You know, the military really wants people to feel like they have a military identity and identify strongly with their branch of service. Is that part of the training, and should we consider how we're training?
You know, that's a really great question. I think certainly, you know, one of the goals of the military is to build that camaraderie, build that unit identity. And, you know, that's as a, you know, there's a very specific reason for that. When things go bad, you want to be able to rely on you. Those around you, you want to be able to feel that bond, that trust in each other. And the question becomes, well, what happens when you leave? What happens when it's over? What's left then? And I think one of the things, there's been some news reports the military and the government have been looking at kind of doing a kind of a reverse basic training, that is to help people start to reintegrate. And this is a big change. When I got out of the military 10 years ago, we had 3 or 4 days of briefings where we sat in a big room and they kind of told us what was coming up for us in terms of reintegration. Here's some things to expect. And I think that was a good effort, but I think we can do better. And I think you're seeing some of those things where the government's really looking at these ideas of kind of reintegrating people in, helping them kind of get back used to their civilian lives, their civilian identity, to help with that transition. And, you know, that really, it's an interesting thing for me. I was in the National Guard. And so when I got deployed, I was living in Minnesota at the time. I was in the Minnesota National Guard. And there was men from all over Minnesota who kind of got grouped together, and we got deployed as a group in units we'd never been in before. That's a very different experience than someone, for example, who's active duty Army or Marine or whichever branch they happen to be in, where they live together and they spend all of their time together. And so when they get back, they continue to spend all their time together. And for those of us in the National Guard or the Reserves, we kind of went back home. And so there's really different needs there based on kind of what branch you've been in and those types of issues.
So do you think it's good or bad for a person to still have a lot of friends who are veterans or still in the military? Do we know?
You know, that's a really good question. And the answer is that We're not really sure. I don't think anyone would argue that someone should get home, leave the military, and disassociate themselves from their military friends. I think in many ways, friends can provide a support function. In fact, a group of my friends is organizing kind of a 10-year reunion because it's just about been 10 years since we got deployed. Those relationships can be very valuable. One of the things we know that really matters is social support when you get back from a deployment. And being able to rely on your friends who have been through the same thing is absolutely essential. I think the really good question is, at what point does that become not beneficial for some individuals? I think in general, having military-related friends is probably a very good thing. The question is, are there some veterans, some members of the military for whom that starts to create problems? And how might that arise? And that's something we still need to study.
And Stephen, how do you perceive your time in Iraq now as a veteran yourself?
As I mentioned before, for me, it was really something that I kind of view as a positive experience. Now, there's kind of an old joke in the military that you always kind of look back on the military really positively, even if your experience wasn't necessarily positive. But for me, getting deployed when I did, going through the experiences that I did, I think it really helped me grow up. I know many of my family members said to me, you've really kind of matured, you've grown up, you're a different person than when you left. You have kind of a better perspective on the world, those kinds of things. So for me, I think overall, you know, if you'd asked me during it, I probably wouldn't have said it was a very good experience. But I think looking back, it really led to a kind of a time of kind of personal growth and maturity in my own life.
Do you have any advice for others who will go through that experience to come out of it as strongly and positively as you have?
I think that one of the kind of the key things, at least for me, was using that opportunity not just as a, well, this is a time away from my family, this is a time away from my friends, but really kind of looking for opportunities within that to experience different things, to have kind of new experiences, to get to know people that you don't know, to spend that time kind of away from the daily grind of your life, kind of examining things like, you know, what do I want to do when I get back? I think it's so interesting when you see veterans, guys from my unit who before their deployment, they had kind of one career trajectory. They got back and they kind of went a different direction. And I think those are the people who took that time to really think about, hey, what is it they want to do when I get back? I'm going to have a little bit of money saved up. This is kind of an opportunity for me to make a change if I want to do that. And I think taking advantage of that opportunity can be very good.
What are you hoping will come out of this study?
One of the things that I'm really looking for is in what ways does the military stay with people once they've left it? It's obviously, can be a life-changing experience for some people. Again, for some people, they get home and it's not important to them. And when I think what we're trying to figure out is to what degree can this identity serve as a positive thing, and in what ways might it get in the way of good functioning? And then the next question becomes, one, you know, is this amenable to change? Can we help veterans identify with the military, their experiences in a more positive way? And if it is amenable to change, then how might we go about doing that? You know, other than saying, you know, wear more T-shirts or whatever, or have fewer bumper stickers or whatever that might be. But what are some ways that we can kind of help people as they transition from being in the military to being a civilian again?
Stephen, thank you for talking with me.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Stephen Lancaster is an assistant professor of psychology at Drake University. River to River continues in a moment on Iowa Public Radio. Coming up, I'll speak with a veteran who ran 416 miles for this year's RAGBRAI. That's in a few minutes after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury in for Ben Kiefer. This hour, we're talking with veterans about how difficult experiences can shape a person and how someone takes meaning from their experience. My next guest is Army Captain Richard Kresser of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. He's an Iowa native, Iowa State graduate, and this year he ran on foot the entire length of RAGBRAI, the Register's annual great bike ride across Iowa. Richard, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
We'll talk about this year's RAGBRAI in just a moment, but first I'd like to ask you about your experience in the military. I spoke a few minutes ago with Stephen Lancaster of Drake University. on how military service members define themselves after deployment. And you were deployed to southern Afghanistan during 2012, which at that point you were first lieutenant in the U.S. Engineer Corps. Do you see yourself differently after that year overseas?
I definitely do. My deployment itself was a moderately easy one. I was doing construction management for most of the deployment, but one thing that I did really affect me was being so up close and personal to a lot of soldiers who were serving who did not have nearly as easy of a deployment as myself. And seeing them every day going out outside the wire and doing their mission, I was on the same base as our route clearance company, and their main job was to go out looking for the roadside bombs. And just seeing what they went through every day, and especially when they took some losses, it really did change how I look at service and how it affects people. And so that, after that experience, I really kind of wanted to help give back, and not just from veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, but as well from service members from other conflicts as well that have definitely had much worse experiences than these conflicts as well.
So, Richard, you joined the 2008 RAGBRAI as a bicyclist, but what made you decide to run the entire route this year?
Well, there was a lot of boring runs on the base where I was at. I worked some 15-hour days, and the only kind of outlet was just running laps around the FOB. So, and after too many laps of that, your mind kind of starts to wander. I had been wondering about running RAGBRAI for the past few years, and kind of got the idea through boredom there that maybe I should try it. And it was kind of once I got back from the deployment and really kind of started reflecting on what it had all meant that I kind of decided to attempt to do it for the Iowa Veterans Home as well.
You have raised more than $17,000 over the course of your trip, with proceeds going to the Iowa Veterans Home in Marshalltown. In choosing an Iowa Veterans organization, did you see a need that wasn't being met?
Absolutely. I definitely wanted to keep it local to Iowa. Since RAGBRAI is such a community-oriented event, I didn't really want to do it to a nationwide veterans organization. And after I contacted the organization there, got in contact with their deputy commandant and their mental health director, Dr. Steenblock. They raised the issue to me that they had been wanting this certain type of equipment called biofeedback therapy for some time, but just did not have the funds to purchase it. Really hit home for me, this biofeedback equipment. It uses electrical sensors, and you see responses to certain types of therapy where it can condition you to not need medication and rely more on mental conditioning to treat some post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms. And being a runner myself and knowing the power of the mind and just being able to have mental toughness and mental willpower through it, that type of equipment really hit home for me. And I was really happy to be able to raise so much for that biofeedback equipment.
Mm-hmm. And this process, biofeedback, can you give us an example of how it would work? You know, if I'm a veteran, I'm suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, I come in, you know, how would that work?
Yes, it's over a series of 10 sessions or so, 10 to 15 sessions, but it's just some equipment where you are connected to some electrical sensors where you can see the results of the therapy. So they measure your skin temperature, your heart rate, temperatures, all those things. When you're having an issue or some sort of symptoms, the psychologists run you through relaxation techniques as well as other ways to help treat that, and it's instant feedback. It's the instant biofeedback, hence the name. You see the results of those relaxation symptoms on the visual output screen from the electrical sensors. And over time, over 10 to 15 sessions of this, your mind can start to be conditioned where it does those automatically whenever you're having an issue with both post-traumatic stress disorder as well as chronic pain. And over time, it can reduce or even eliminate the need for medications to help treat those.
Wow. So being aware of what your body is going through is pretty helpful in helping you get over some of these.
Absolutely. And that's one thing I've learned as a runner is you really have to listen to your own body. Your mind is obviously your most powerful tool, and being able to listen to that and condition it in certain ways can definitely be very beneficial.
So Ragbri begins. It's Sunday. You get up early, strap on your shoes. Take us through that first day.
The first day, almost every day was a different experience. Each of the 7 days was a completely different one. The first day, it was just full of the excitement. I'd gone through a three-week taper, so I was just bursting with energy. Finally, so excited to have something I'd been planning for a couple of years be in the works. And especially just seeing how much everyone was calling me crazy along the route and just in kind of disbelief of what I was attempting to do was pretty great.
So you were getting called crazy. What was your interaction with other cyclists like?
Oh, not every cyclist, but about every third one or so would either throw out, you know, some type of comment. They started off early in the week just calling me crazy, but as the weeks went on and more bikers saw me out there, it was more less getting called crazy and more just cheers of support and way to go. And the last day, it was just wonderful. Everyone was, congratulating me. Once they kind of realized I was going to be able to make the whole week, they were just all about congratulating me and, saying how much I was able to inspire them. And if, there's someone sucking going up the hill and they see me trying to manhandle my way up the hill, I help them, with the biking as well.
Now, the second day was the longest leg of your trip. How were you holding up on day two?
Yep, I was attempting to do each day of Ragbri in the same mileage of the bikers and not sort of split up mileage. And if there's extra mileage there, I kind of have to do it. So I did the Karis loop early in the morning. But as it turned out, with Monday being the hottest day of Ragbri with highs in about 93 or 95, I think, as well as the Karis loop adding an extra 24 miles on to make it a 107-mile day, ended up not being able to finish that day out all on that day. So I started overheating in the early morning, and just even though I was hydrating right and I was fueling right with electrolytes and fuel, I just was not able to ever really get my body temperature low enough, and I just spent all afternoon in the heat of the day just trying to take enough breaks just to not overheat and burst my engine. But came out the next morning where I finished off the day prior and knocked all the rest of it out except for the little dog leg up to Perry, about 14 miles, I got off out of it.
So, you're keeping up with bikers. Throughout the run, on average, about how many hours of each day were devoted to sleep and running? And I don't know, did you have time for much else?
I thought I might have a little bit more time for the fun aspects of Ragbri at night, but kind of turned into if I wasn't eating, drinking, sleeping, or running, I was wasting time. So I try and sleep about 4 hours a night. Some nights I only got about three. And anywhere from 13 hours a day to 18 hours a day out on the road running. I'd have some breaks in there, half-an-hour breaks in some of the pass-by towns to take a quick nap and get some cold drinks in me. But, it just depended on the mileage. But pretty much the large majority of the day was just running. So I'd start earlier in the morning than the bikers. Usually start under a moon and the stars, just real nice, peaceful running. And slowly but surely, the bikers would start to increase. And then I'd outlast most of the bikers. Usually they'd be in the towns having some good beers by the time I'd get in there.
So,
but I tried to have one or two beers every day, though. You got to relax a little bit.
Well, I was going to ask, did you have fun on the ride? Did you try to not miss out on too much of the fun aspects?
Oh, absolutely. There was if there was a slip and slide, or if there was a pond or something along the route, or a pool, I definitely took some time off to go partake of that, and always had a few beers along the route too. So definitely didn't get to have as much fun as the bikers, but my fun was in a little bit of a different way. But I definitely plan on coming back next year and riding the route and making up for a lot of the other fun times that I missed out this year.
And you had a couple companions for some of the trip.
I did, yep. I had a great support crew. My mom was biking along with me the entire time with supplies, water, and fuel and changes of shoes. And my dad was driving our support truck through the towns, letting me stop in with him and pick up some more food or anything. So, and I had a few others day by day join up with me as well, a few college friends, my old commander in ROTC from ISU, some great support from Casey's where he works now. So, but yeah, it was great. And I linked up with another Ragby runner on one day of it too, Peter Kolstelnik, and he was the other runner out there that some people might have saw. And so yeah, so definitely had a some real great support crew out there to stay with me for some miles.
Mm-hmm. Is that how you occupied your time? Did you chat with them, or did you have some time to just think to yourself? What was going through your mind?
Usually the mornings were a real good time to just kind of collect my thoughts for the day. I'd usually start off anywhere from 2 a.m. To 5 a.m., well before the bikers. Usually pretty cool, clear nights with the stars. It's a very peaceful running to kind of just reflect on how the last couple days went, what was going to be in store for that day. And so that was some real peaceful time. And then as it went along, just chatting with people next to me, there were many, many bikers who stopped to bike a little bit slower alongside of me and chat, talked with a few veterans, talked with one lady who had just recently lost her son from my base, a Special Forces soldier near where I was stationed at. So I had some great chats with some folks. And but along the way, you know, you could stay as entertained as you could with all the crowd shouting out words of encouragement. So it was never a lack for entertainment along the route.
If you've just joined us, this is River to River. I'm Emily Woodbury in for Ben Kiefer, and I'm talking with Army Captain Richard Kresser. He's an Iowa native, Iowa State graduate, and we've been talking about his Ragby journey this year. He ran the entire route 416 miles on foot. Richard, you know, Ragby is kind of known for its food. It's not always healthy food, but it's known for having pretty good food. You know, what and how much were you eating?
Well, I was trying to eat it or treat Ragby as an eating and drinking contest. It's pretty much the best way to describe any endurance sport. So I was eating as much food as I could. I'd stop and get the farm boy breakfast burritos. I'd stop in the lunch towns, a little church barbecued pulled pork sandwiches, pretty much anything and everything, getting some slushies. There's a lot of Casey's breakfast pizza along the way. Once it gets to that point, your body can kind of metabolize any sort of fuel or food for fuel. So whatever is appetizing at that point. And a lot of the times it's less, the healthy foods and more just the fatty, greasy, salty things are what you're craving. So that's kind of the one treat to running that long distance is you can kind of partake of all that junk food and not feel bad about it.
Well, you know, let's talk about the mechanics of your run, too. You know, you were eating some extra calories, but how did you maintain yourself physically?
Well, there's been many months of training leading up to it where I did my first 100-mile race back in March. Went very well and got under 20 hours on that run. But since then, I've been trying to train for back-to-back long days of doing 50 miles of trail running on a Saturday and then 30 or 40 miles on a Sunday, just getting my legs used to waking up again the next morning and working all the lactic acid and all that out. So as long as you're maintaining a consistent pace, a very slow, moderate, consistent pace, and you're eating and drinking, you can kind of eventually just go indefinitely. While I was running, I was trying to maintain 12-minute miles. Just the entire thing behind it is just you just got to pace yourself and you just keep going.
After 7 days of running Ragby, was there a physical toll?
My body was definitely pretty beat down after that. By the end of it, my temperature control was probably what was most messed up. I kind of would go through fevers, and then I'd go through chills and sweat at really odd times, even though I knew I wasn't hot. But after 1 or 2 days of that, it got back to the status quo, and I was able to just get right back at her.
You know, the runner's high that usually people get if they run, you know, let's say like 5 miles. Were you in and out of euphoric and daunting moments throughout the trip?
Absolutely. There were so many highs and so many lows. As I described before, that Monday was one of the lowest lows I've had while running during the Century Loop day when I just was just overheating. But yeah, there was just definitely many highs throughout the day, and especially coming into Fort Madison, that was just one of the most outstanding times running of just everyone along the route cheering and knowing that the finish was only a few miles away. And ran by one dream team, some teenagers there, and just the entire line of them was just high-fiving me for about 100 meters, and so it was just pretty incredible to go through all that.
Would you say that was the best day, the last day of the trip?
Oh, absolutely. I wasn't expecting that scenic of a route, too, but we kept weaving in and out of the Des Moines River Valley, went through some outstanding towns, and just knowing that the finish was only a few miles away was definitely the last day was absolutely the best.
You didn't put your tire in the Mississippi River. You jumped in.
Yep. Yeah, that was I kind of had that planned out many, many months ago. That's throughout all of my training, throughout the entire ride, that was what I kept visualizing was the Mississippi River. And just, not even just doing 1 foot or 2 foot, but just going out and doing my entire body, just jumping in. So it was, that was definitely a great feeling. It was, felt pretty good after that many miles, take one last final dip.
So is your body recovering now?
Well, actually, once your body is used to getting up and running 50, 60, 70 miles a day, even a few days of not doing that has astounding recovery. So actually, by the middle of last week, I was feeling pretty good and actually just went out and did a climb of Mount Rainier here in Washington State with some friends and my sister. So, and I have a 60-kilometer race on this Sunday. So right back at it, and I'm feeling pretty well rested already.
What drives you to do all this?
It's just the urge to be active and get outside and just see how far I can push my body. And so far, I've been continuing to increase distances from a marathon to a 50-kilometer race to a 100-mile race, just to see how far I can go. And you know, Ragbri was just the next step of that, to see if I could do that challenge. And I definitely did, you know, possibly reach my limits on Monday. I was one of the first signs of had to kind of take it easy. But it's just the drive to see how far you can push yourself.
Did the experience of running Ragbri change you?
Absolutely. It made me much more thankful for what I have, and just the ability to go out and do this stuff. Originally when I got the brainstorm, the idea, I was kind of just looking to do it a little bit low key, and but to all of my supporters along the way, some family friends from childhood who helped me build the website and start the fundraising campaign, Michael Schmidt, to my family, my sister helped me with the media outlets, to my mom and dad helped me along the way. It's just been an incredible group support the entire way. And so it was just really great to see everyone back, get behind me and back me up for it. So just made me thankful for what I have, and looking forward to continue that and not take it for granted.
Richard, thank you so much.
Yep, well, thank you. I appreciate it, Emily.
Richard Kresser is an Army captain with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. He's an Iowa native, Iowa State graduate, and now he will be known as one of the first people to complete Ragbri completely on foot. To read about his journey and find out more about donating to the Iowa Veterans Home, you can visit runningfarther.com. River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Dennis Reese and John Pemble. Podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River are available at iowapublicradio.org. We always welcome your comments and questions about the program. Contact us anytime at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Emily Woodbury. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.